with the trees, and it basically channelized it all into a wash. And so downstream, there was a lot of catastrophic flooding in the suburb of Baltimore. You probably heard about this. So my question to you is how much has upriver development affected flooding with the communities that you're working with?
Thank you for that. That's a really good question. And it's really complicated. I think that one of the things that we're trying to work on now through the funding that we've received to create this watershed management guide is really understanding the causes of flooding and the upriver, the upstream issues that are contributing to flooding downstream on the coast. And so when we think about coastal region of South Carolina, for instance, so we know that we have increased storm activity. We're having more hurricanes. We're actually not even hurricanes. We're having even more rainfall events, higher rainfall events during the wet season, which is winter. And so these are events that aren't even associated with a hurricane. So we know that's happening. We know that Myrtle Beach and that whole entire area is one of the fastest growing areas on the eastern seaboard. And so the rampant development and unsustainable development that's happening in the region is creating more and more impervious surfaces and somehow contributing, we believe it's contributing to flooding, right? But we're not sure how. We have an increase in sand mining in the region as well. We have, this is in one of those slides, but the PD watershed, if you go further upstream into North Carolina, we have a corporation called Duke Energy. Duke Energy is a humongous power company who owns on the PD six dams. And because they're having high rainfall up there, they have to release those dams in order to prevent a dam failure. And so when they're releasing their dams down there, we do know that when they're releasing their dams up there, we do know that a day later downstream we're having flooding. But we don't know, there's so much mileage, it's such a huge watershed, we really don't know. These are all assumptions, right? But we really don't know what is causing the flooding and what is attribution and to what extent as well. And so right now we're performing, with this funding that we've received, performing a lot of different hydrological studies to better understand what's happening upstream and how it's contributing downstream flooding. Thank you for that.
Thank you for answering. And once again, we're seeing how what one party does affects another party, and it's really a systemic issue.
So we're going to open it up now.
As always, SCJ members get first crack, so.
Yeah, Annie's going to bring the, okay, someone's already got their hand up.
I just have a quick
request.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Brittany Cordero with St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks so much for being here today. Kind of have a couple questions that are related to each other, but I'm ultimately wondering, we have a problem with toxic chemicals getting into our water and managing that, along with just access to water, right? So, and access to clean water. A lot of our waterways are on public lands, and where waterways are on tribal lands and managed by tribal leaders, we have the EPA coming in and really trying to focus on how tribal leadership can help those waterways. When it comes to waterways on public lands, that's a more difficult task because we have a lot of different players coming to bring tribal stewardship onto public lands, and what does that look like? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mary Lee Sesh. I'm going to try and start to answer that question, and then I defer to some of my other panelists. So, yeah, I mean, my opening comments really didn't give credit to the Columbia River Basin. You know, it's gigantic, and there's a lot of issues. And there's also a lot of private land, but there's a lot of federal land. And, you know, as Brian said, you know, one of the things that's kind of like smacking us around right now is climate change. Because everything's going to be worse. Water quality is going to be worse. Toxics are going to be worse. Flooding, as we heard, everything's going to be worse from climate change. So climate change is like, you know, it just gives us more pressure. So, I mean, I think the one thing that we have tried to work to do, in the Columbia Basin, and there's a couple people in the room that know about this, there's just been this like 30-year battle about the Endangered Species Act and the dams and governance and who gets to decide what the federal government does with the dams. And what we set about doing when we decided to really focus on how do we protect tribal human health and other very, very populations that are more susceptible to toxics pollution from higher fish consumption. We said we gotta create this landscape where everybody's engaged and everybody's a partner. And we gotta figure out how we join partners with the federal, you know, we have to have the federal agencies at the table. How do the federal agencies join with public-private partnerships? How do the federal agencies partner with nonprofits? And so our collaboration, I think, by, you know, just like creating a table where everybody's at the table, and then in my work at EPA, I was working at a higher level with the federal agencies and pushing on them to be a part of this work. At every opportunity I could, every meeting that we had, I was pushing on the federal agencies to be a part of our collaboration and to commit funding and to commit people to be a part of it. And as a result, we do have partnerships. I mean, there's still a lot to be done, but like, for example, we have really important partnerships with the U.S. Department of Interior, with work that U.S. Geological Service is doing, USGS is doing with monitoring, and also with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We have, you know, we're still working on some of the partnerships with the Corps of Engineers, of course. You know, they've got this kind of weird funding thing where you got to have a fit, and Brian probably knows about this with the Mississippi, where you got to have a 50% local input, and so we're still working on our partnership with the Corps. We have a much stronger, the Bureau of Reclamation has the ability to go in and do strong partnerships at the local level, and so I think we've had a stronger relationship with that. So I think it's about creating a table and then having people, you know, like, Corps of Engineers, we need you to talk about this highly contaminated site in the middle of the Columbia River, and then eventually that site became a Superfund site last year, finally, after 50 years of legacy contamination. And also, Bureau of Rec, let's talk about, like, what's going on in the Yakima Basin, and how can your work that's dealing with flooding help support some of the work that's going on with toxics reduction? I just think it's an opportunity. I think it's giving everybody an opportunity to be equal players and equal participants in the conversation. So that's my contribution. Brian,
do you want to add? I actually want to pass the mic. The only thing I would say is that there is a pattern now of trying to get more voices in the room on almost all these issues. It's driven by everything from, you know, equity issues, but also just driven by a change in policy. So the more voices you get in the room, the more people are involved in that. It may take longer, but the end result is you get something that resonates with more people. Having said that, I still don't think we're anywhere near as close to getting those voices, and that's probably where I need to add mine.
Yeah, specific to tribes, there's a lot of opportunity right now. Water is a little trickier. There's certain agencies that have authorities that easily fit into I'll say co-management, but one of the things that's interesting, Dean Kevin Washburn was former Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs, and he's been kind of speaking a little bit in this space, and he's been championing the idea of 638 contracting, which is a federal program where tribes can basically get contracts to take over federal responsibilities on ancestral lands, on for resources that are important to tribes. So you can see how this could play out in like national forest lands. This oftentimes is focused within a tribal reservation, but it also could apply outside. Bureau of Reclamation doesn't have that, doesn't fit neatly in there. But I mean, we've seen this in Bears Ears, right? But not everything has to be a monument to make the tribes a meaningful player in there. And when a lot of this happens through agencies, through regional and local offices, you can create those relationships with tribes because the ability is there, right? So the Supreme Court one side said they don't have to do it. There's no law saying they have to, but they can do it. So there's nothing preventing the agency from doing these things. Ultimately, the federal agency can't delegate the final decision on public land to somebody else. But that's kind of the limit of that, right? They can, I mean, a tribe can be in very close partnership and work on all the issues hand in hand and reach a solution. So I think that there's a lot of really good space, and there's a lot of movement in there too. You know, if you track Interior right now, Brian Newland, who's the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs now, his office is doing quite a bit. So it's, you know, it's as big as taking over the bison range in Montana, to a lot of smaller things where we're talking about managing parks in historic area, in the ancestral lands, things like that.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I would love to add as well, a perspective from our indigenous peoples in the Southeast as well, is that, you know, I think in the conservation field, especially among the big greens like American Rivers and other big green groups, there's a natural gravitation to work with federally recognized tribes. And this is I do believe that it's very, very, very important. And I also think that there are a lot of state recognized tribes and unrecognized tribes who aren't getting a lot of love as well. And so I really would love that as we, you know, talk about bringing more folks to the table and making sure that everyone has a voice, don't forget your smaller tribes, your tribes that don't own land, that don't have a reservation. Those folks are very important to seek out and bring to the table.
And I just want to add to that, because there's also a lot of tribes that live in tribal people that live in urban areas that aren't associated with reservations, and they're really important to pay attention to, because a lot of times they become invisible communities, and so that is something that's also really important. And we have a nonprofit in Portland that works with the tribes that are located, the Native American Youth Association, and they do phenomenal work. So that they're a really important partner. So I want to just make sure that people pay attention to the tribal people that don't live on reservation or they don't have a place.
On that point, California is, I don't know how many of you work in California, but the California lobbied so hard that the Congress refused to ratify the treaties that the United States made with the tribes. I think maybe a handful. So at basically the turn of the century, 1900, there was only five federal, they call them military reservations. And that's all we had for tribes at about 1900. And things have progressed a little bit, but there are dozens, dozens, and dozens of unrecognized tribes there. And they are kind of just trying to find their voice and trying to find some foothold. And as we read about the Central Valley Project and the Sacramento River and everything that happens in the middle of California, what you don't hear is that what are the tribal rights involved there? What are the Wet'suwet'en, what are their rights to salmon? What are the fish needs in that river? We have the ESA kind of as the backstop, but the ESA provides this much about what you have to do to keep them from going extinct. And the way that agencies interpret that doesn't say this is what we need to actually make them healthy. This is what we have to keep them from dying off completely. So California is a really interesting situation. I've been really involved in my non-Colorado work on standing up this, helping the state in their 30 by 30 program, which is projects and even land back to help improve some of these and get better outcomes on land and waters. So, yeah, thanks for that question.
Thanks so much for doing this. I'm just curious, you all representing different different basins, different regions. I'd be curious what issues with toxics you see coming next in your regions. And, you know, I think these things can sometimes, it's almost like a fashion fad, right? Where there's a new toxin that we're maybe five or 10 years behind and catching up to. So what's next on the horizon? And then if not, are there legacy pollutants that journalists aren't paying enough attention to in your region? Oh, this is Evan Bush with NBC News.
This is Brian Hopkins with the Nature Conservancy. So I'm sort of pulling on some of my previous work representing state agencies. And I will tell you that one of the things I think is a fundamental misunderstanding by the public, and I'm not trying, please don't think I'm being condescending here, but there's an assumption that state agencies and federal agencies are out there looking for issues and chemicals so they can stay in front of concerns. But the reality is how it works in terms of water quality, the Clean Water Act, and then how it's delegated to states, is that until a criteria is set for a chemical, it's essentially not on the radar screen. You're almost blind, even if you know about it, the ability to sort of enact standards, to enact protections, to look at a watershed, to do a TMDL on that watershed, and all the things that trigger from looking, pre-existing elements from the Clean Water Act. Until that chemical is gone through the process of having defined criteria, your hands are tied. You know, there's no state agency that will go out and regulate a chemical that has not been defined in terms of what its acceptable concentrations are, what its outcomes are, how you analyze it, et cetera. They're not in front of it. So to answer your question, one of the emerging things is phthalates. Now, we've heard a lot of this in terms of human consumption and whether or not we should our drinking containers, but there's a growing body of evidence that phthalates and then some other byproducts that come out of waste treatment systems interfere with the endocrine systems of fish and that are inhibiting our reproduction, especially in fish that tend to have long lifespans and also delay their spawning events, sturgeon being a perfect example of that. So I'm going to end it there because I don't want to pontificate on this, but I will tell you that sort of suite of unknowns is a very good question, but it's important to understand how that gets acted upon. State agencies and federal agencies are not out there, they're not even able to enact protection regimes until the science and the impact criteria have been defined. And what does that mean for you all? It means that these emerging contaminants where there is evidence, typically in research programs from universities, et cetera, which are beginning to show that these are a concern, it's important that conversation reach the public dialogue because that's what drives policy and that's what drives the eventual establishment of criteria, which then leads to enforcement, which then can lead to protection mechanisms, Superfund sites, you name it. So long-winded answer, but I wanted to help. I think oftentimes there's a disconnect between an understanding of what agencies can do versus what we would all like to have in terms of stewardship.
So I'd like to answer this question by giving a little bit of background about how we got into toxics in the Columbia River Basin. So at the time I started working in the Columbia River Basin in the early 90s, there was this big salmon recovery program going on from the Endangered Species Act and the 13 salmon and steelhead species that were listed under the Endangered Species Act. But we were also hearing at EPA from tribal people saying as we bring back these salmon in the Columbia River Basin, and we're going to eat more salmon and maybe go back to what we ate at one time, are we going to be exposed to more toxics? So we conducted fish consumption studies and fish contaminant studies, and we found contaminants of great concern, of human health concern, like DDT and PCBs and mercury. And that's kind of, you know, how this all happened, because what was happening with the salmon recovery work is these watershed councils were happening all around the basin, and people were like putting in logs in streams and getting cows out of the streams and doing whatever they needed to do to like do salmon recovery work, but nobody cared about toxics because you can't see this stuff in the water. And that's when I said, we're going to create a collaboration that's going to focus on toxics. And so we did a State of the River report, and we looked at what's the science out there, and we saw in the Columbia Basin, we saw PCBs, we used some indicator contaminants, PCBs, mercury, DDT, and PBDEs, polybromated diphenyleners, with the ethers, which is a flame retardant, and that, at that time, was considered an emerging contaminant. That was a flame retardant that was found in everything. I used to go into meetings and say, lift up your seat, and you'll find the tag underneath your seat that PBDEs have been sprayed on your chair. So, but then, like, just to go to EPA, EPA regulates 121 contaminants, 121. There are 30,000, you know, known and maybe more than that, chemicals in commerce. So we've got this gigantic, like, it's just like what Brian said, you know, EPA is not regulating, like, all the stuff that's going on, but at all anyway. And it goes back also to what Brian said about the importance of your work in relationship to how we get some of this information out. So in the program that we have now and the funding, like, for example, we're funding a collection of municipal dischargers to do some PFAS. PFAS is a big contaminant you've probably heard about a lot. There's a lot going on. EPA is doing a lot more to try and regulate and assess PFAS. So municipal dischargers are looking at PFAS, and they're going up the waste stream to figure out where it's going from. We've got some, we've got the University of Washington looking at emerging contaminants, and they're looking at phthalates and other emerging contaminants in the lower Columbia to try and understand, what do we have, you know, what's going on? We've got researchers in Idaho, like right here, looking at mercury in crayfish. And also, we've got the Nez Perce tribe in Idaho looking at phthalates and mercury and other issues in both the salmon and the Clearwater watershed. So I think that, you know, hopefully as, you know, as, and this stuff, you know, it's, I think there's stuff like this happening all over the country. So hopefully as some of this information comes out, as you continue to try and work with people to share some of this complicated information, we can help move toward, and I'm not sure regulation is the way, because one of the things that happened is I worked really hard for about 8 years on a upgrading Oregon's human health criteria to protect tribal fish consumers, and we came out with, in 2012, with more protective human health criteria. And that human health criteria has never been implemented by the state of Oregon. So there's just a lot of work that needs to be done, a lot of public information, and we need to figure out, I mean, like the work in Oregon, like going up in the watershed, where is this PFAS coming from? How can we understand source reduction in that way? I think there are opportunities there.
About emerging contaminants too, so we'll be talking a lot more about that. Where was the question? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Barb. I'm a freelancer. So my question is for all of you, and it was kind of a good follow-up to the previous question. I'm curious for each of you, how much, in terms of the general maintenance and the upkeep of your specific watersheds, how much of your work is treatment, and how much is prevention, and how does that discrepancy, that assumed discrepancy, affect the impact that you are trying to have?
I actually find that to be such a really insightful question. So I served on the Gulf Capoxia Task Force, which was looking at the issue to do with nutrient loading to the Mississippi, which then when it reaches the Gulf, due to degradation of the chemicals within that Gulf coastal system, creates a low oxygen zone. It's remarkable how big it is. So you sort of get a, what they call a dead zone off the coast. And these hypoxic zones are happening on large river systems all over the globe. And so one of the truisms in what your question is, or at least you certainly resonate with me, is that once these things are in large river systems, that's not, you can't do anything about it. The ability to treat within large watersheds is significantly limited. Now, treating in the smaller watersheds and treating when you get, you know, if you have the water pass through an opportunity to do so, that's one thing. But once the contaminant or the nutrients or the sediment, so it's not always some, you know, esoteric chemical, is in those systems, there's very little that you can do to try to get them out. So to answer your question, or at least to drive home my personal belief, is prevention is everything, because it's the only place that we really have control. But the good news is we're really sloppy right now. How we do our land management, ag management, stormwater, how we do a lot of what we do is pretty, almost could describe it as infantile compared to what we could do. And so we have a lot of opportunities for prevention and to kind of clean up our relationship to how we treat water. Just simply understanding that the water that falls on a farmer's field is eventually going to end up in your glass of water, and is eventually going to end up in a coastal zone, where it's, you know, how that water behaves through that whole system is critical for every one of those facets.
I also think that's a really important question. I think that some of the best solutions that I've seen, good solutions that I've seen are these watershed management councils that seek to do both prevention and treatment, or prevention and restoration. I'm recalling one that we worked with, the Catawba Watery Management Group. This particular watershed is managed by a utilities throughout the watershed, Duke Energy, and also private citizens. And there's a watershed management plan that seeks to do just that, prevention and also restoration. And this watershed, they call it one of the hardest working watersheds on the East Coast. It does a lot of work for us, but at the same time, it is super, the management of this watershed has resulted in, when we compare it to other watersheds in the region, the water quality in this watershed, considering how many cities are on this watershed and how many people are intaking, how many utilities are intaking from this watershed, it is a very healthy watershed. Of course, it has its issues. We have CAFOs, we have PFAS issue, but we don't have PFAS in Catawba. But anyway, but compared to other watersheds in the region, it's relatively healthy. So, throw that out there.
Do you still have a question?
I'm Mark Schlesting with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. And Brian, this is sort of aimed at you, but for all of you guys, we're sort of talking around the domed elephant in the room, as I put it, which is Congress. Can you guys tell me a little bit about what reporters should be reporting on to get to the issues that result in states like Louisiana having to rely on the kindness of strangers, states like Iowa and further upriver, to reduce nutrients or other issues in different water bodies to deal with the issues that are facing them, in our case, the dead zone? How can reporters address this in the context of Congress?
So I'm going to give my answer, I suppose, with having worked in policy work for state agency for a long time. So I actually feel like I have some viewpoints on this. And so this is not snarky. It's going to sound snarky, but it's not. I think it's a practical answer to your question, which is that you have to create safe space for a political leader in order to get them to move in a direction that you want to. So criticism is useful, but sometimes you want to find a way that they can move into a position that helps them look good. Because at the end of the day, that's the calculation that they're going to reach every single time. And so when you're working with congressional members, and TNC definitely, especially on the Mississippi River, a significant portion of what I consider to be our portfolio of effort is in policy work, funding, making sure, like for the Upper Mississippi Restoration Program, which gets about, now it's getting about $90 million a year, to make sure that funding is happening every year is a critical element. So as you work with congressional members, it's finding a moment where they can at least look good or they can weigh in on something and not get burned. And so I am going to provide a piece of information that might be helpful. So my experience in being in that element of things for quite a while is that if the partners that are involved are not unified, so if you have five groups, environmental groups, municipal groups, et cetera, who all perceive a problem. Let's talk about nutrients, but maybe sedimentation is the issue. And if there is a unified voice as to that this is a problem, that something needs to happen, some funding needs to go in this direction, then you're in a pretty good place. But the minute one of those groups starts bickering and arguing with the other, a political leader will just take five steps back immediately. They're not going to touch an issue that there's not a unified voice within their constituency as to what the issue is and what should be done about it. And so we often shoot ourselves in the foot by airing out issues that we probably need to, well, we do need to talk about, but we could probably do it in a context where we're trying to resolve those internally and focus on making sure that we have a unified external voice. Now, this isn't a direct answer to what the journalism can do, but I think the onus is on the groups that are vested to try to create a single voice for what's going on if you want a politician to get on board with you. You can't have even a whiff of controversy or confusion because they'll just simply walk away. So what does that relate to with the press? I think the press then is the mechanism for getting that unified message out. And so, you know, it's probably not so much in your realm as it is in the realm of the folks who are working on these issues to provide you with a clean, unified message. Because that's the only way you're going to track something through, as you mentioned, this semi-dysfunctional system we have in D.C.
So that's a really great and important question. And as you know, I worked for EPA, and we do what Congress tells us to do. And we, you know, we do what Congress directs us to do. And I started working on the Columbia. You know, after I had actually come from the East Coast, where I worked in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, which gets a lot of funding. And when I came out to the Northwest, I was stunned that the Columbia didn't get any funding for water quality work efforts. And so over time, through our work and building our collaboration, legislation was actually introduced in Congress in 2010. And for a lot of different reasons, it didn't make it until finally it was passed in 2016. It didn't get funded in 2016 because, remember what happened right after that. And then it got funded we got our first amount of funding, which was only $1 million for the entire basin in 2019 when the House of Representatives changed. Meanwhile, actually, even though the Senate was Republican, the Senate was advocating funding for the Columbia. So, you know, that just gives sort of like a historical thing, and now, obviously, our funding actually has increased over time. We've had senators, Republican senators, supporting funding for the Columbia Basin. But Congress is really important. And I think that one of the things that happened in the Columbia is when it first was introduced in 2010, it was really focused on the lower part of the basin and folks folks may know, there's these really, you know, just like there is in the rest of the country, there's strong polarizations, like Eastern Washington and Western Washington, Eastern Oregon and Western Oregon, and also the whole state of Idaho. And Senator Merkley, who was introduced the legislation, he worked really closely with his, you know, he worked with Idaho congressional representatives to try and get this legislation passed. And he really changed the legislation based upon what they wanted. So he acquiesced to them. And, you know, so having said that, and I think what we have continued to try to do is there are people in the basin, like in the eastern part of the basin, we have farmers who are very, very conservative, who are working closely to do things that are reducing toxic environment. And trying to get, and there are communities that are very conservative, and trying to get those stories out there. And, you know, going to the people that are actually doing the things in the communities, that then their congressional leaders can see the work. And that's how the legislation was passed. The farmers in Eastern Washington went to their legislators and said, we want this program, and we want this program to be passed. And I think the press could do a really important job of telling the stories of the people that are in the communities, you know, just right at the very grassroots level that are doing the work that, you know, can help congressional people see what kind of leadership is needed.
I've got something just quickly here. Not as much on Congress, but maybe as even the administrative agencies. At the start of this administration, I was a political appointee within the Interior Department, and I jotted down here what some of these ideas were just in our discussion is. Journalism, I think, can really be helpful helping get ideas out. And the reason I say that is because, like we would have mentioned, I mean, federal agencies are not going out there and figuring everything out and bringing it to people to ask for their opinions. Even in Colorado, they're like, well, we want the states to figure it out. Okay, everyone states, you guys figure it out, and we'll just kind of, we don't want to have to do this by ourselves. And they don't. Because you do want these decisions to come up from the ground. But a lot of times, I feel like my sense is sometimes media can be reactive rather than proactive, and that's just because that's how news is, right? But in some of these places where we're able to talk about what the solution, what people are offering up as potential, like, you know, in the Klamath for, you know, we have this, especially things that kind of coordinate, that fit within the administration's priorities, because they don't always have to be totally agreed upon, because the administration takes different priorities. Each one, so you can speak to certain things differently. So that's kind of one place I think that journalism could be, you know, very influential, is by helping to raise those voices of what the good ideas are, to have a ground swelling to them. Otherwise, you know, it could be a little reactive.
And I just want to add one piece as well. I think that, like, a lot of the funding that's come down from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, a lot of funding in the last round, it was applied for across the country, and a lot of that funding is not being released. And a lot of that funding is actually going towards addressing issues like toxins, like resilience, and that kind of thing, but it's not being released. And so highlighting that problem as well, we have numerous groups who were awarded funding, but have not received it yet. So give us some money. So it's a very important issue, and it's prevalent across the country right now. So,
hi there. Thank you again for being here. So I'm Kitty Dahl from the University of Florida, soon to begin reporting in South Florida on the environment for TC Palm. And just a follow-up to what you all have been talking about, can you speak more about the vulnerable communities that you work with? In my area, a lot of mobile homes, speaking about flooding, are impacted. And then how these communities are gathering and creating solutions. I saw today something, I saw photos of gardening. I was curious about that. I just would really love to hear more about these meaningful solutions that you're seeing in your communities.
Sure. I didn't even get to that part. intentions or one of the community-led projects that we did with the Bucksport community was a rain garden project. We installed several rain gardens throughout the community. And it's just a way, I think, you know, rain gardens are great. But they're only going to, say, manage low to moderate flooding. But it is a way for each resident to manage the water that comes onto their property, right? But some of the flood events in Bucksport and other communities in the area is going to take a bigger concerted effort to manage like severe flooding. And so what one of the projects we have going on now is a hydrologic study to evaluate flooding, water flow throughout the community, and that's using both, I guess I'm not a hydrologist or anything, but the technical science, but also community-based knowledge, right, local knowledge to do that. And what will come out of that is a restoration project for the entire community that not only incorporates, you know, green infrastructure, but also incorporates the cultural interest of the community. They want folks to come into the community and learn about their community and learn about their Gullah Geechee heritage. So it'll incorporate that. It'll be trails. It'll be a walkable community. And also, we're looking at the economic piece, too. How can we generate intergenerational wealth also through this restoration plan? So it's going to come out with the end result will be a restoration plan that addresses all of those issues. So that's just one. In terms of other communities, there are other communities throughout the region as well who are dealing with catastrophic flooding. One initiated a state park, and a state park that also initiated the creation of a state park. It's called the Black River State Park. It's in a traditionally low-income African American community. Oh my gosh. I know. But and it's also geared towards also creating intergenerational wealth, highlighting cultural resources in the community. And so, and I really honestly think that community based approaches are, at least in our region, the best approaches so far. Just because when we think about equity, and especially racial equity, these communities are just traditionally left out of the conversation. And so what the work that American Rivers and our partners have really concentrated on is really bringing local community voices into the decision-making circle. And I think that is the crux of the work that we do, is not only inviting folks to the decision-making circle, but to also make sure those communities are actually heard and taken seriously when they get there. That's also a problem, because otherwise it's just a checkbox. You know, we've invited them and now, well, you know, we don't really have to listen to them, but we check that box. And so, and that takes constant vigilance. And so I'll drop off there.
So I want to add a little bit to that. So some folks may know that EPA got a gigantic amount of money for our environmental justice program as a part of the Inflation Reduction Act. And I think the number is in the billions. it's just almost too much for me to be able to grapple with from my career at EPA. But just yesterday, EPA announced $177 million that's going to be going to 17 technical assistance centers around the country. And a lot of those technical assistance centers will be working with environmental justice communities, environmental justice nonprofits in these watersheds that were represented here, and then watersheds that aren't represented. And I highly recommend, I mean, it's just an extraordinary amount of money. I think the Center for Justice in just got about, I think it was $17 million or $13 million. I mean, just an extraordinary amount of money. So I really encourage you to look on the EPA website, find out about these, in your area, find out about these awards that were made. There were 17 awards around the United States. They all have partnerships identified in the award packages with environmental justice communities, like in my region. There's a Latinx community that just is like a mile north of me. I can walk to a called Verde that was part of the a technical assistance funding that was. So it's all over the country. So I think that is a great story because that's going to be a game changer. And it's just an incredible influx of money going to these communities. I would venture to say that they will be able to be more engaged in a lot of this watershed work. They'll have more of a say. They'll be able to fund people to be participating in science and participating in decision making. And I think that's a great story for you guys to tell.
I actually want to ask a question too. Is this on? Yes. I'm Tegan Wentz. I'm the editor for the Ag and Water Desk, and I wondered if you could zoom out a little bit and talk about watershed management systems that work. I like what Daniel had to say about reporting on solutions, and it's something that we've been really trying to do since we launched in June. We've done a number of stories of working at MATI about proposals to pass some sort of multi-state compact for the Mississippi River Basin, but even within the environmental groups that we're interviewing and talking to, there's not a lot of agreement on what that should look like. And so I guess I'd like to hear from you about systems that are working, like the Klamath and maybe the Great Lakes, and how we can interrogate some of the proposals that we're reporting on.
Okay. It's a good question about what's working, because what is the measure of what works? I mean, one thing that I've written down is our West Coast, like, all our West Coast rivers have been in the same litigation, ESA-based, for 20, 30 years because the salmon and the fish aren't doing well. So I guess it's hard for me to understand, think about what is actually working, right?
The answer, there's an inherent element to your question, which is that it's not working right now. And I agree with that, but I think that most of these large river systems have some frameworks involved. The Upper Mississippi River Basin Association is a governor-appointed board that represents those states. You have 12 different agencies across six states in the lower river. You have Orsenco, which is actually a congressionally established group within the Ohio. So there are management frameworks. Even in the Missouri River, you have the Missouri River Implementation Committee, which is an ESA-based driven issue. Where the problems have to do is the classic thing that maybe is just an element of human nature, and it has to do with turf. So it's when you begin to start talking about you need to govern the entire river across, certain principles need to be implemented across the entire river, then it becomes complicated when you look at pre-existing infrastructure, groups, and making sure that they don't feel threatened by providing a role for them in a broader governance system. And so the Conservancy has been working with America's Watershed Initiative and looking at what we think can be done there. We're actually having some pretty encouraging initial conversations with some federal agencies as well. It's so preliminary that I don't really think that we would do any justice to look at it right now, but I think the most important response I want to give to your question is that there is a growing understanding that some kind of broader governance needs to be occurring on these rivers. That there needs to be a big picture thinking, that this compartmentalization of regional concerns and zones has been useful on a regional basis, but that it fails miserably to look at large issues, which certainly climate change is driving. So I'm not providing you solutions, but I am optimistic that the desire to move in that direction is definitely building, and TNC is absolutely want to see that happen.
Thank you.
I think we'll know pretty soon whether or not the governance system like Colorado is working. I mean, this is a moment. This is a very intense moment, and these, for right or wrong, it really has caught a lot of people somewhat flat-footed. And there's a huge, like, ideas being discussed and cuts, and the situation is really kind of overwhelming in a lot of ways. And so that's pushing the governance system significantly. And this, of course, this doesn't really account for what the tribal side, which has always been where it is over here. So I'm just talking about kind of the states and how the states are negotiating. And so we'll see. I mean, it's possible we come out of this in a place that there's some sort of agreement and not animosity and litigation. That's hopeful. So I guess and that system's always been adjusting itself ever since 1922, since they created the compacts and all the litigation has been. I mean, of course, the last 20 years when all the different agreements for surpluses and then shortages have kind of been built up. It's always been adjustments onto the governance model. And kind of we'll see what we can figure out now. It's kind of, but this is a much more stressful moment than it has been.
I just want to quickly respond. So, as Brian said, the challenges, watersheds are complicated. We have these very challenging problems. And it's complicated. But in my experience, and this is why I built the Columbia River Basin Restoration Program, when you have people coming together that represent a watershed, and there's an equal playing field, and they're figuring out together how they can work together, that, I think, is the model. And there's some examples, like EPA has the National Estuary Program. There are 28 estuaries around the United States, including many in areas that you represent, where people have been working for about 30 years to bring science together in collaboration and solve problems. My Columbia River Basin Restoration Program, there's the Great Lakes Program, there's geographic programs around the United States that are working together, and I think those are good models, and I think they bear looking at, but I think it's about people coming together and working together and not somebody saying, this is what you do and this is how you do it.
I just wanted to add that I think, you know, I also bring up the Catawba Watering Management Group. I think in a mainstream sense, they're an excellent example of a watershed management council, a watershed management group that has brought together different entities, federal entities, utilities, private landowners, et cetera. But what is missing, and they've been very successful, you know, but what is missing, I think, is a lot of folks in the watershed who are the most vulnerable and most impacted are not invited to the table. And they are invited to the table, but the table does not accommodate them. For instance, they have the citizen engagement groups that meet in the middle of the day on Thursday. Like how can your average, you know, working class person make it to that session? You know, and I think what I've seen with a lot of watershed management councils or watershed management groups is that they're very top down. They really invite a lot of folks from what we call the grass tops to these tables. And one of the things that we are trying to do in South Carolina is make, you know, local community members the center of the watershed management council that we're trying to create. So I just wanted to add that piece.
I just wanted to ask one more follow-up question. Talking about turf, Daniel, we know that when it comes to the Klamath, you've got not only tribes versus farmers, but sometimes tribes versus tribes. I ran into Klamath tribes as a lawyer last week. Yes. You know who I'm talking about. Yeah, no comment. But the thing is that just looking at the Klamath as an example, how do we resolve these turf conflicts and go into more of a holistic watershed-wide management model?
I think think we've been discussing that with these collaborative groups. I mean, what's the tricky thing on the Klamath, which it's probably not unique, is that we have a tribe on the top who holds an extremely large, old, tiny memorial water right. And they have a fish species who is dying and cannot recover because the water quality from ag runoff is so bad. This is the whole thing. Like they cannot figure out how to get these fish to come back. So they're trying to keep the lake high, but at the same time, the lake's also the source of the mainstream call of Klamath River, which we need water in there to support fish who are, the salmon who are also not doing very well because of water quality issues too. So we'd have this tension between the two of those tribes there. And I think the tribes in the past have worked well together. So I think it'll come back. I think it'll come back. It's just that the state of the fisheries are so poor right now that it creates, there's really no way out in a good way at this moment. But this dam's coming out is going to be significant, and it's possible. So, but I think these intertribal relationships are really important. And that river is just so special in that way because those are the strongest voices on the river, management.
I think of climate change as a disruptive force. You know, you have things are working the way that they've always worked, and suddenly you have extremes that are kind of disrupting these old systems. We're seeing this in California. And then they also have the potential to disrupt the way that these places are governed. So, opportunities for new power structures to emerge or for the same old people to maintain their power. So I'm wondering, are we yet seeing climate change having a real impact on watershed governance? And if not, what would you like to see, or what do you think should occur?
I'll take it real quick. I think climate change is like giving us an unbelievable urgency for action. And so everything, from a water quality perspective, from a flooding perspective, climate change doesn't give us a lot of time to screw around. We've got to get some action, and we've got to get it soon. So I think that's a brief response to that question.
Speaking within the framework of the Nature Conservancy, so from a restoration focus, it's an interesting, first of all, I don't think we fully embrace what it means for climate change, and I don't know that it's been incorporated at the level that it will be. We're on the beginning phase of that. It's interesting to look back, and 10 years ago we were in a climate denial phase, and I think we're probably past that now, and most people begrudgingly one way or the other realize something's happening. One of the areas that I would put on your radar screen in terms of climate change and restoration has to do with the as we're looking to bring back or preserve function within these river systems that are increasingly changing the way the water moves through them, so that its hydrology changes, we're actually getting to the point where we may need to look at those restoration efforts from a how do you protect them from climate change. And it's a complete shift in terms of what it means to do restoration. You may actually have connected floodplain that is connected to the river, but you want to put in a control structure because the river is not behaving normally, and you don't want the river to come in because it's not a natural flood pulse during certain cycles that probably are climate-driven. So this idea of what does it mean to try to preserve and restore function in a river system that is beginning to behave significantly different is an interesting tug and pull, and a lot of the restoration community, conservation community, is beginning to look at what does it mean to build in climate resilience to your local restoration efforts. And I would say that conversation is just starting. but it's going to become increasingly an important one. You know, you may have done a fantastic job of bringing clarity back and vegetation and appropriate species and shoreline connections and floodwater, and it all becomes completely overwhelmed by an unnatural hydrologic cycle. So I wish I could tell you that we have, you know, really direct answers on this, but I think it's actually becoming, it's knocking on the door even within the conservation community. What does it mean to adapt? And then you can take that entire thing I said and just substitute for environmental, biological, you can start talking about communities and resiliency and flood pulses, because it's almost the exact same dynamic is occurring within those communities as well.
In the western, you know, part of the United States, we're so snowmelt driven that, I mean, this has to hit the ground in a very serious way for water managers. Like, what's real? What can you rely on from year to year? Because I think the status quo was, okay, we look at our forecasts and this is how much water we're giving out this year. We're going to run it down to here, then we're going to refill it, then we're going to do it again and again and again. And that model hasn't held up in the last 5 years. We see that in California, where there's a lot of unmet need in a lot of different places, right? And so that's what got us in the Colorado situation as well, because we think that it's coming back, but it's not. So we have to figure out whatever we thought the baselines were. Your amount of error and room has to improve, and you've got to change what you're looking at, because you just can't obviously rely on those numbers.
Yeah, and I would like to add to that in the Southeast, a lot of folks in the Southeast are actually looking out west. I wouldn't call it inspiration, but as an example of what could happen in our region in terms of water supply and flows and population growth and the pull on our water resources, and thinking ahead, we're thinking about right now, yes, we're in the flood cycle. Right, but just 10 years ago, we were in severe drought. A lot of the Southeast was in severe drought. And I think I think there is a short-sightedness at this moment. You know, we just have to deal with flooding. We just have to deal with flooding, and everything is going towards flooding. But the drought period will come again. It will come again. And for me, I do believe that, yes, we need to address flooding, but we also need to look forward and be anticipate drought once again. But I do think those conversations are starting, and we have been looking a lot to the West, to what you all have been, what has been happening in the West, but also how you all are managing pull on your water resources and aridity, honestly. And aridification of your landscapes, and anticipating that could happen in our region as well. So,
okay, we're on time. Will you thank everybody for their thoughtful questions, and thank the panelists for their great commentary and the willingness to answer some pretty tough questions. I encourage you all to get to know them. They all sound like they're going to be really great sources. I already know Daniel's a great source anyway. So thank you all, and we're now going to a break, right?